Welcome, everybody. You are listening to No Coast Cinema here on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. I am Tom Hush.
And I'm Connor Cornelius.
And we're very stoked to be back with you for another week of Chicago Film Conversation. A year now of Chicago Film Conversation.
We've checked the calendar.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's our anniversary time.
Yeah. Really excited. I can't believe from such humble beginnings.
Yeah.
And, you know, recording directly into my laptop.
Literally sitting on your bed at your old apartment in Rogers Park. To hear.
I know. Here in WGN Studios, in Tribune Tower, soon to be former WGN Studios.
Right.
But we'll be moving along with them, and I hope you stick around with us because we've got a lot more great stuff coming in the year ahead.
Speaking of great things coming up.
Exactly. We have a writer and director. He is here to talk about his feature-length film, Porto, starring Lucy Lucas and the late Anton Yelchin. His name is Gabe Klinger. And he has put together a fantastic film here, a tight story that follows two star-crossed, I suppose, lovers in the city of Porto in Portugal. It's a very emotional and breathtaking story that really can tear at the heartstrings and frames love in a very interesting and...
Circumstantial
and, as I said, heartbreaking way. Welcome to the show, Mr. Gabe Klinger. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So let's start off with you as a filmmaker. What got you into it? Yeah, what got you there?
I guess I got fired or from every other job. So I'm unemployable. So I had to create my own kind of job. I've been doing film stuff for most of my adult life, and I suppose it was kind of a natural progression. I started making little movies when I was a kid, using my mother's Sony video 8mm camera. Then when I was a teenager, I bought a Super 8 camera and was developing film, and then bought a 16mm camera, and then I started getting really into watching films. And I became like a movie buff, and I was living in a foreign country where I didn't speak the language, and I didn't have any friends, so I was just going to the movies a lot. And so movies kind of became my friends, from that, it just became kind of an obsession, and completely replaced my social life, this activity of going to the movies. And then it became, luckily, when I was 19, I moved back to Chicago, which is where I spent a good chunk of my youth. They were hiring at Northwestern University for the Block Cinema, where they have their film program there. Mm-hmm. They do a quarterly film series. And their film programmer was off on a kind of a sabbatical, and I was hired to fill in. And that was my first kind of like serious film job. This guy named Scott Curtis hired me, and I just started programming movies and then, introducing them to people. This was in 2003. Mm-hmm. So a long time ago. It just kind of all started there. At the same time, when I was about 18, 19, I was part of the Chicago Film Critics Association, and I was, getting access to press screenings and things like that. So I wrote for a few places in town. I had my own little magazine that was publishing online, and it was just a way to access films and a way to talk about films. And so I was just doing that in a more professional capacity.
And so it all kind of stemmed from that. Stay in the foreign country that you didn't speak the language and you were just going to the cinema a lot?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it was Barcelona, Spain, and my parents just had the idea to move, uproot us, my sister and I. And at first it was just like, what are you guys doing? This sucks, we had to leave behind all of our friends, we had to leave our school behind, and you know how it goes
right.
when you move. And then in retrospect, it was just absolutely brilliant parenting because, who doesn't want to have, Europe as your backyard,
Right.
And, that's where I discovered like the great European art house cinema and all, started watching really weird movies. And I don't know if I would have gotten the same exposure in the burbs here in Chicago. You know, who knows? Right.
It's weird to think about that in retrospect. You know, it's an alternate you, an alternate version of you that got a different film education. And it's weird to think that if you had not, it makes me wonder, having, as you said, Europe as your background, especially a city like Barcelona, so beautiful, so historic, you know, I think you can see that kind of appreciation for the old style city in Porto.
Totally.
There's definitely like a personal touch with this film, with Porto.
I know that you were actually born in Sao Paulo, Brazil, correct?
Yeah.
How long did you spend in Brazil?
The first 4 years of my life, I think. Yeah. First 4 years, there was a period where we were kind of going back and forth. So when you look online, some of my, these, you know, when I'm asked that, it says 6 years. Other times it says 4 years. It's not consistent. Four to 6 years.
An air of mystery.
Yeah, exactly.
Clearly you remember it very well.
Yeah, right. I remember docking off in Miami, not literally. We flew into Miami. That was my first access point in the U.S. And already at the airport, laid over, I made a friend. And I was, you know, like a kid that was my age, and we were hanging out in the terminal, and I already started to speak English. So when you're, you know, 4 or 5 years old, that's like, that process is
right.
Really, you know, I just, right. Yeah, we loved natural. that experience. But then when you're, you know, I was 13 when I moved to Barcelona, and that was awful. You know, it was just like,
well, it's like, you know, it's a tough year of your, you know, tough time of your life. You're really starting to come into, you know, a lot of changes. And then all of a sudden, you know, just like, you're in Barcelona and you're spending your adolescence in a place where, as you said, you don't even know the language. Totally different cultural context. Yeah.
So you don't speak Spanish. Do you speak Portuguese?
I do. I speak Portuguese and I speak Spanish now, obviously. Uh-huh. That feeling of I don't know if, you know, this is a good moment to segue into Porto, but I think that feeling of loneliness, I certainly experienced that in Europe. And when I was talking to Anton about his character, Jake, you know, he's this American loner living in Europe, right? I mean, he's not exactly me. It's not exactly biographical, but I saw there were kids in my school who were kind of like that. They were from other places, and they found themselves in Spain kind of searching for themselves. So there was a bit of that in his character.
So yeah, let's jump into the film Porto. Perfect segue. Where did the initial idea for Porto come from? You mentioned this kind of feeling of loneliness and kind of a listless personality for Anton's character.
Yeah,
where did that all kind of spring from?
Yeah, I mean, you know, looking, it wasn't exactly a conscious thing writing it. I wasn't thinking about that history. It occurs to me now when I'm, you know, talking to you guys, right, talking, you know, touring around the movie. But at the time I was writing it, and I mean, I think it starts to become conscious when the actors start asking you about it. You know, like when
what's the motivation?
Yeah. What's who am, like, who's this character? What should I be? You know, and you want to kind of come up with something authentic there. And that's what I channeled. I channeled that experience, those kids who then they graduate school and they don't move back home. They sort of stay there. They stay in that place, but they're still kind of cultural outsiders. So so I was definitely, when we had an initial draft of the script and I shared that with the actors, and Anton came back and read his character and said, can you tell me a little bit more about what you were thinking? You know, and then I started to go back, and that you know, shifted the dialogue, the backstory a little bit, and, you know, so, what else? I mean, there were certain things like structure that are, you know, important to me. Like, I wanted to do a movie in three parts, and I wanted to have these three film formats, Super 8, 16, and 35 millimeter, and so I wanted to design a story around that structure, which is, you know, kind of what they tell you in film school is first come up with a story, then come up with a form.
Right.
And we kind of did it the other way around. We approached it counterintuitively. And I'm kind of a formalist. I like formalist films. I like films that are working on this, you know, formal level. So, you know, I thought it would be interesting to sort of design that and then come up with a story that would fit in that. I also thought, first-time narrative filmmaker, I'm going to try to do a small story, you know, two people, largely interiors, and that's going to be easier than doing, you know, like, let's say tackling a historical epic my first time, yeah, around, you know, or a war film or whatever. Sure. But of course, that's a mistake, because whatever you take on is going to be challenging. If you're going to make, right, an intimate love story, you want to make the best intimate love story that you're going to make. You're not, you know, you're not going to be lazy about it just because it's a love story. You're going to try to make it dynamic within those limitations. So, so that's, I mean, there were, it was a combination of those types of things. I didn't want to bite off more than I could chew. We've all been in romantic relationships. We've all been disillusioned in our romantic lives at one moment or another. And so I could channel from there as well. I could channel from the experience of my collaborators. You know, Larry Gross, my co-writer, Lucy Luca, the actress in the film, my editor, Geraldine Mangineau, my producer, Sonia Bushman. They were just people who were, I was talking to all the time during the pre-production and post. And every step of the way, there was, you know, we'd introduce a different layer. There was something, mm-hmm, that we were all, we could all relate to this experience that the characters were having. Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting that you used three different types of film in order to sort of capture those movements within, uh-huh, the movie. Like, you say, you speak about the movie as if you were trying to limit yourself conscientiously, but to use that, that's like, you know, that's pretty innovative, I've got to say.
Especially the way that's used in the film with, you know, certain, I guess, not timelines, but time, you know, periods in the characters' lives are, right, shot in a different type of film, different aspect ratio. And it felt really nice as a viewer to have that kind of visual reference, like, okay, yeah, I know where I am right now. And, sure, that's that form you're talking about with, sometimes when you're telling a story in this manner, people get lost. They're not sure where, yeah, they're supposed to be along the characters' lives. But I never felt lost at any,
oh,
point,
good,
during Porto. It was really,
I mean,
great,
people do, and there's some intentional kind of ambiguity about time in the film.
Sure.
It kind of starts to blur a little bit. If you're following the movie emotionally, you're not following it in a linear way anymore.
Right.
And that's okay. We were, right, okay with that in the editing process. I was like, it's not a, you know, Wes Anderson with the Grand Budapest Hotel did the aspect ratio thing, mm-hmm, to delineate past and present, right?
Right.
Or to shuffle between, or they like bookends, if I remember correctly.
It's, but like, it's just, it's nice to have the like aesthetic reminder that something has changed.
Absolutely.
Even if you're not,
yeah,
like you said, even if you're not like following along,
yeah,
narratively.
Yeah. Oh, totally. And but I think, you know, Anderson, he is sort of like a formalist on this. He's very rigorous.
Yeah.
I haven't seen Isle of Dogs yet, but I'm very excited to. But it's he's, you know, I wasn't exactly thinking of Grand Budapest Hotel, but it was sort of, that was a movie that sort of legitimized the idea of using different aspect ratios in different mediums, mm-hmm, for us. Especially since he does like Super 16 work and all his movies. You know, it's just like, well, if Wes Anderson can do it and people can follow his movies, okay. You know, it was just sort of, it was
like a proof of concept kind of
thing. A little bit, yeah, yeah. Like it was something, even when we delivered the movie for like streaming and stuff, and they were like, what's with these different aspect ratios? And we were like, well, Wes Anderson did it.
You know? That was your response?
Yeah, 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 pretty much.
What would Wes Anderson do? Well, and if he can do it.
I don't know if you wanted to go into something else, Tom, but I'm really interested in the distribution for this movie because, yeah, it came out, it was acquired by Kino Lorber in November of 2017, is that right?
Yeah.
But it was made in...
In March. It was like out of South by Southwest.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
Yeah, yeah. So a little earlier.
But it was released in the festival circuits in 2016.
Right, right. Only in like Europe and Latin America. Mm-hmm. So it was like... And then, then there was like a big push to sell the movie in Berlin the following year. It's a long process. Like... I'm envious of filmmakers who kind of, like, they have a movie at a festival and boom, it's in release and then they're done,
yeah,
you know? I've been touring this thing for, you know, a year and a half and it, yeah, feels long, you know? Like, ask my fiance. It's like, you know, it's
just a constant hustle to, yeah, try and sell this to someone and get,
yeah,
people to look at it.
And if it's an auteur film like this, you know, a little art house movie, it really does, and especially if you don't have your lead actor around, you know, yeah, I mean, that's a big burden to fall entirely on you. And also you feel kind of a big responsibility to get his performance out there, to really promote his performance,
right,
because I think, you know, there's so many things I know he would have been excited to talk about. This is Anton Yelchin, of, mm-hmm, course, and And so there's been, yeah, this sort of responsibility of, like, let's do the best job we can. And, you know, not only because of Anton, although that's a big reason, but, you know, because of everybody else. Wyatt, Lucy, Larry, the whole production team, just because everybody worked for pennies.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you do that and everybody's really proud of their work, you just want to make sure the movie's going to have a great life. Whereas I feel like with some of these, you know, higher budget movies, everybody, you know, gets paid. That's the expectation is, you know, the movie's, you know, gonna get out there one way or another, and
right.
That's fine, and that's it. You know, but no, it's a big hustle, as you said, but it's great too because you get to, you know, travel the world and see things, and it's interesting to see. I don't think a lot of filmmakers have that sort of firsthand contact with their audiences the way you do when you kind of in this artisanal way, like, travel around with your film. So I'm like, you know, I'll be in Hong Kong or in Portugal or in Sao Paulo, where I'm from, you know, and I'll see the way audiences are reacting. And it's really fascinating, the differences between, you know, like the movie's in release in Mexico right now. So I'm following the activity on Twitter and stuff like that of how people are reacting. And it's like, you know, and you get new reviews that come out and stuff like that. And it's always really fascinating, like the different points of view you have about the film, the different reactions and
right.
stuff.
Yeah. And it's very rare that, yeah. you know, it's like reading a book and then immediately you could, when you're traveling around with it, you could potentially get to talk to the author.
Yeah.
You know, in
yeah.
that sense. And when you're following these reactions to the film, you know, do you follow with any sort of fear, anxiety? What are the emotions as you watch Porto make its way?
You do at the beginning a little bit, of course, like that first festival. The first festival for us was San Sebastian in Spain, mm-hmm. Which is becoming more of starting to have more of an international profile for, like, American indies. Matt Porterfield's film Solar's Point premiered there last year. A couple friends from New York. My friend Nathan Silver is an independent film. He mm-hmm. came through Chicago recently, I think, did something. But they were looking at a film that they produced to premiere there. And it's just like it's a beautiful place. Very, you know, very enthusiastic audiences. You know you're going to get full houses. It's going to be, you know, a great experience. And so I felt very lucky premiering there. And you're always, of course, a little trepidatious about how people are going to respond internationally. But the cool thing, at least about like a festival like that, is, you know, at least those trade reviewers and stuff are all, they're going to watch it on the big screen, you know, they're going to be there at, you know, with all the excitement around the movie. And so it's not kind of like watching it at home on a screener. So we're very fortunate. We got a great Variety review just right off the bat. I think that's one of the first reviews that came out. So after that, I started to relax a little bit, yeah. you know, like...
That helps, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Ease the tension.
Yeah, so, but it was okay. You know, I think you get to a certain stage in the editing and the, you know, and the whole process where you're comfortable with what the movie is. And, you know, hopefully nothing's going to alter that later on. I think you just have to remind yourself that, you know, like, oh, yeah, there's a group of people who are, you know, sort of my confidants who put their stamp of approval on it, you know, and that's good enough for me, you know. And I think, I don't know who said it, but yeah, like, my co-writer, Larry, he's like, you don't do it for validation, you don't do it for reviews, you don't do it even for money, you do it because it's fun, because you learn something from it, because, you know, you put yourself through something to get to another thing. You can't do it for accolades or whatever,
because right.
you're going to be frustrated your whole life.
You it's know? Storytelling.
Yeah. yeah, totally. And it's supposed to be very personal, right? So, but you hope people connect to it. And yeah, the curious thing is that in certain places, people connect to it more, people connect to it less. Just culturally, things mean something to certain people.
Yeah, do you notice any cultural differences, like, between the
yeah.
Europe and, you said also, obviously, South America as well?
I do. I mean, yeah, there are people, like, in North America, people tend to read Anton's character in a really negative way. And that's okay with us because that was part of the design of his character.
In what way? What is the like negativity?
Oh, that he's a creep and obsessive, and he certainly is, and he's got all those negative traits. I also happen to personally find things about his character endearing. And the complicated thing about the timeline of the film, or the complicated, you know, we don't hold your hand emotionally through the film. We complicate things, the path. We give you sort of like a kind of, you know, a jagged kind of swirly, you know, scenic route, let's say,
right.
through those emotions. And they can get ugly sometimes. And I think there are audiences who are okay with navigating that and coming up with their own conclusions. And then there are other audiences who are a little bit more used to the filmmaker kind of holding your hand and taking you through that and telling you, this is what you should feel here and this is what you should feel there. And I think North American audiences, especially, you know, I don't know. It's hard to generalize because this, I mean, right. It's such a big country. But I think sometimes things that we were sort of intentional on our part or sort of hands-off on our part in terms of the storytelling, people here perceived as us not entirely being like successful in terms of our storytelling. Whereas in Europe, it's sort of, oh, well, this is the sort of art house language that we're used to. So they had no problem kind of navigating that. I know it's the old cliche, like, my movies are understood in Europe and not in North America, you know? Like, it's like going back to, like, you know, the 50s with, like, people like Howard Hawks and John Ford and, you know, like, my movies will be appreciated in France, you know, that old cliche. But it's kind of true. There are certain market expectations here, at least, that are unrealistic when you're releasing a small movie like this. And the frustration for me is that, and not just for me, but for my friends' films that get released too, like a lot of Chicago filmmakers, I see this happen too. Like, they're just making their little movie, and they're happy if it gets, you know, a few showtimes at the Siskel or at the Music Box or whatever, but then everybody else in the industry is like, no, you got to get a sales agent, you got to get distribution, you got to do this, you got to do that. And they're like, well, you know, I mean, and if you don't have that stamp of like Sundance or Cannes or whatever, and there are really good films being made in Chicago right now, but that don't go to those festivals, don't get that pedigree because they're not part of that system. You know, they're not. From the beginning, they don't have a producer or sales company attached that means something to the people who program those festivals, so they don't get the attention. But so I'm digressing here, but what I mean is
we're going to talk about hockey soon.
So. Yes. Oh, good. The mechanism that exists here in the States, the discussion a lot, as you guys know, is around things like awards, box office, distribution, and right now we're particularly in an interesting place where things are online a lot, and there's this whole economy there that we're not entirely clear about how that works yet, and films have way more visibility now, but yet we still use this metric of distribution and box office and reviews and tomato scores and blah blah blah,
right?
And there's some kind of flaw behind that, I think, for things like the Emoji Movie or, you know,
Transformers 8.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's okay. Sure. I think those consumeristic, hyper-consumeristic appraisal mechanisms are fine. We need them. Families, you know, are going to go out to a movie
the
over
average
the weekend.
Consumer.
They totally need them. For somebody who's going to go see a little art house movie at the Siskel or at the Music Box, I don't. You know, I think that that's different. They need some other discourse to be going on and to help in the appreciation of the movie. And I think that's where the mechanisms that are in place are failing those audiences a little bit. But that's not to say there aren't wonderful critics and wonderful people doing things a lot. So that's been a little bit of a frustration here. At the same time, dude, I got a theatrical release. I got my movie's on Blu-ray. My movie's going to be on, you know, it's like,
it's coming on to Netflix this month.
It's, you know, it's awesome. It's like if I look back at this movie in 5-10 years and I'll be like, oh yeah, we totally accomplished what we set out to accomplish. So
Yeah. Getting into the story of Porto a little bit, I really enjoyed watching the film. Two things really jumped out at me. One, the incredible visuals of the film. I think shooting on those three different film formats and just shooting on film at all was a fantastic decision. I've never been to Porto. I've never been to Portugal, but I really appreciated it from that visual standpoint. I think it was extremely successful there. And also the story of telling this kind of difficult relationship, for those, you know, our listeners maybe have not seen this. It revolves around kind of this one night stand sort of situation, a night of, unmitigated passion in a lot of ways and kind of the aftermath of that. I know also on the home release here, you have Double Play, which was a documentary you shot with James Benning and Richard Linklater. Richard Linklater did the Before trilogy, and this is a long roundabout way of saying did that at all? Did the Before trilogy, which has a somewhat similar idea, it's a lot of walking and talking and just watching characters develop. Was there any sort of influence on Porto from those?
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, I think I just internalized. I'm old enough that I watched them as they came out.
Right.
So, that's, you can't really replicate that experience if you're new to them and you just pick up the Criterion, you know, box set and just go through them in a weekend or whatever.
Right.
Like when I watched the first one, I didn't know there was going to be a second one. And when the third one came, you know, I had a sort of suspicion, but it was still kind of like, you know, a jolt. And that sense of that playing with time, those gaps in time, was really fascinating to me and sort of opened up my mind to what cinema is capable of. Linklater was certainly influenced by like the Antoine Doinel movies, the Truffaut films, you know, and the gaps between those films and the character maturing, and the Michael Apted Up series and all that stuff. And so those are such amazing experiments, and so absolutely. So there's, you know, as in Porto, we're playing with this gap in time, but it's not between films; it's in the film, right?
Right.
It's like the gap. So in a way, I did consciously sort of think about that idea of, well, let's play with ellipses. There's time passing with these characters, but let's put it into the movie and, you know, collapse that sense of time. Like in a cut, you can collapse that sense of time. You get into all kinds of other movies that use that same device, like Alain René's films, Muriel and Hiroshima Mon Amour, Last Year in Marienbad, and I mean, there's so many, but the Wes Anderson movie we were just talking about, Grand Budapest.
What was it like getting your actors in, like what kind of notes did you have to give them in order to get their characters developed with those different time periods? Because that sounds like a bit of a challenge.
Oh, man. Well, one thing we did that was really helpful is the first day of production, I had a special makeup team come in and put like old age masks on them, like put old age makeup to make them feel like the sense of like displaced in their bodies.
Right.
Right. So both Anton and Lucy were aged to age 80.
Nice.
And we weren't sure if we were going to include that as a poetic device in the film at any point. So we filmed it all in Super 8, and I have those like outtakes and stuff. Uh-huh. But Anton walked through the school where the makeup department was set up, and kids were like holding open the doors for him because they actually thought he was 80. Yeah. And he was like drooling.
Nice kids.
Yeah, drooling out of the side of one. You know, and he was really, I mean, he really sold it. And I think from that first day on, the characters really, they felt, they already kind of reflective about time and aging, you know, and that was really helpful. So that was a little trick that we used. But, it was just, I think, different, you know, a lot of the times you talk about superficial things, like what does my hair look 10 years from now, you know, and stuff like that. But we wanted to talk about, motivation. They were both kind of lonely people. And they weren't, you don't necessarily change over time. They're just things that become more pronounced. So I think that's what we kind of focused on, this idea of, these characteristics are already inherent in your characters. let's just make them a little bit more pronounced as you get older.
And even physicality played into that with Anton. He had a bad back. And you see early on,
totally.
it's there. And then it was so crazy to see him, you know, years on that time shift, and he just looks so kind of haggard. His hair has a little bit of salt and pepper in it,
yeah.
And it looks like he's just having complete difficulty walking, but it was really nice to see that it was set up already. You saw him physically have a little bit of it, and then, as you said, more pronounced.
And that's one of those nice things that ties in time change more, like, make more sense, right? It ties it all together.
Absolutely. It was really fantastic to see.
That Jake walk, we called it the Jake walk.
Yeah.
But so, like, a few months after the shooting, I was in Paris for part of the post-production, and my editing assistant there, she was watching all the rushes, like, just going through everything, synchronizing sound and all this stuff, mm-hmm. and she got really obsessed with Anton's walk, right? And then a few weeks later, we were all in Cannes together, and Anton was there. He was showing Green Room, right? And my assistant came down from Paris and stayed with me for a couple nights, and I introduced her to Anton, and she was like, "Can you please do the Jake walk?" And he just, like, turned it on, just like that. In a snap of a finger, he was walking down the Croisette in Cannes doing the Jake walk. And it was just so amazing. Like, the way actors kind of, the muscle memory, and it just kind of, yeah, he was just such a pro. It was incredible.
I mean, he really inhabits the role here. I get the sense of loneliness very much from him. Just one look at him, just almost right away. I guess I wanted to broach this subject because I know a lot, it's kind of come back up again, Anton. What was it like working with him? Because he really was a very bright actor in so many ways. He was able to do things like Star Trek, and I remember even seeing him as a relatively young man in Charlie Bartlett.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
And it was really sad and tragic to see him go. Can you tell us a little bit about your relationship with him?
Yeah, it came. I mean, it started from a place of cinephilia. It was on. I'd co-written a book about Joe Dante, and Anton was the star of Joe Dante's Burying the X, which was being shot a few months after the book came out and after I had released my first movie and had already progressed into the very, very beginning stages of Porto. And I asked Joe if I could visit the set. And I asked Anton separately too, like, you know, if we could meet up in LA, but I wanted, you know, make sure Joe was okay with that. I didn't just want to show up on his set. So they both said that was okay. And it was literally like, they were shooting, somewhere in like, West Hollywood, fairly central. And I just kind of like pulled my rental car onto the street, and Anton and Joe were just like on the sidewalk, just waiting for the camera guys to, you know, like get things ready or whatever. And I just walked right up to Anton and I was like, "Hey man, how's it going?" And he was like, "Hey, you're Gabe." And then Joe turned around and he's like, "Oh yeah, hey, there's Gabe." You know, like, and it kind of progressed from there. It was like nothing. It was stepping from real life into a movie set.
Yeah.
Or a sort of movie world where, you know, we'd take lunch breaks and everybody from the crew is like kind of an old Hollywood crew. We're talking about like the 60s and all, you know, like the glory days and stuff like that. And it was just so, we just had such a great rapport going in, and we were surrounded by all these like people who were kind of very supportive in a non kind of a Hollywood way. Even though we were on a Hollywood set, you know, they were just kind of, people were passionate about film. And I had a friendship with other directors who worked with Anton, and they sort of told Anton, you know, you might want to work with Gabe or whatever. You know, I don't know what happened behind the scenes, but Anton basically signed up right away. And I knew I wanted to work with him from the beginning. I'd seen him in Charlie Bartlett. I'd seen him in Only Lovers Left Alive.
Right.
I'd seen him in a few other things, and he just really impressed me. I love the quality of his voice. I love the physicality of his work, his performances. And because of his choices, his recent choices, working with Joe, working with Jim Jarmusch, working with Michael Almereyda, working with you know, these directors who I consider some of the contemporary greats, I knew he was interested in not just Star Trek, right?
Right.
That he was, you know, going to maybe be receptive to doing a little experimental movie in Portugal. And so it just started from there. And he was really keen on it. And of course, the thing that you discover talking to these actors like Anton, or even, you know, Chris Pine or Sean William Scott, yeah. who we were talking about before we started the show.
We will be getting to hockey soon.
Oh, people. good. You know, actors are always hungry for material. There is a serious shortage of good material. You know, there was a point in my life where I was cohabitating space with Greta Gerwig in New York. I was working at the MoMA, and I lived in this apartment, which is the apartment in Francis Ha, one of the apartments in Francis Ha, the middle one.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. That Adam Driver's character lives in, and the other guy whose name I forget.
Oh, that's a rad apartment.
Awesome apartment. It's the lease is not in our control in any of our friends' circles' control anymore. But I came in when Greta was off shooting To Rome with Love, and I stayed in her room for a few weeks while she was off in Italy doing that. And then she came back, and then I was on the couch for a while. I was in my buddy's Oscar's room, but it was just sort of, it was this period where I was sort of learning a little bit about production. My friend Oscar works on the Safdie Brothers movies. He produced Good Time and Heaven Knows What.
Wow.
So, and he's somebody who goes back to Northwestern days. He's a Northwestern grad. So he was around when I was doing block cinema, like in 2002. So small world. And Oscar was working with Noah Baumbach, and you know, I was talking to Greta, and it was just like I was like, she's the luckiest person in the world. She's going off and doing these amazing movies with big name auteur directors, and they were about to go off and shoot Francis Ha, you know, pretty soon. They're kind of getting warmed up on that, and I could tell that she was kind of depressed. The reason that she did Francis Ha, the reason that she kind of got up to making something like Lady Bird, is that the scripts just weren't coming in. They just weren't interesting projects. And I was like, wow, that's incredible to me that, like, you know, there's not like six scripts a day that Greta's getting that are all wonderful, you know? No, there's a serious kind of shortage of these kinds of more experimental, more outside the box movies. And even at an agency like CAA, you know, Anton's agents were at CAA. He had the same agent as Nicolas Cage and people like that. There's like a guy there in that department who just looks at indie scripts. And that guy is hungry for stuff because he wants to be feeding stuff like that to his clients all the time, you know, and because they're asking for it. And those scripts just aren't coming in, either because the people writing them don't think they're ever going to be able to get it to a Anton Yelchin or to a, you know, whoever. But yeah, the mechanism that's there sort of it's the same mechanism that Jeremy Saulnier used to get to Anton. You know, Anton, like, was on a list of people. And when Jeremy, like, submitted his script to CAA, and they were like, well, you should take a look at these people. And they're like, is Anton Yelchin available? You know? And that's the way it kind of worked, you know? And there was the conversation was never, how much money do you have? Never. It was like, it was always about the strength of the material and how passionate the client was about that. So he's off making Star Trek. Mm-hmm. And they're happy because they're making their commission or whatever.
Right.
And as long as in between making those blockbuster movies, even if it takes 2 years, 3 years that they get another big hit like that, they just want their clients to be happy. And they're feeding them scripts all the time. And so I found that process surprisingly easy. Sorry, that was like a big digression.
No, please. Give us the inside scoop.
No, yeah, please.
But, you know, I think that's sort of the reality, is that a lot of it is just bullshit. I'm sorry, I can't.
No, go ahead.
All right. It is crappy TV, is, you know, crappy episodic stuff, fairly formulaic stuff, fairly soulless, you know, Hollywood filler. I think Greta did this romantic comedy at one point with Russell Brand. I don't know if you remember that one.
Oh, God,
one,
Arthur.
Arthur,
yeah. The remake. Oh, jeez.
I mean, like, those are the types. I can't speak for her, obviously, I'd assume that those are the kinds of scripts that she was getting that she was kind of becoming more and more disillusioned by. And so, I think there is some motivation there. Like, it actually kind of gives you confidence that you can actually pick up the phone and probably get something to an actor of that caliber, you know. It's just like a lot of people are discouraged from trying right at the get-go, but Yeah, man. I think Anton, he was just, I mean, I think I was incredibly fortunate that he said yes. But working with him, I mean, he was the youngest guy. I always say this. He was the youngest guy on our set, and he was by far the most experienced. You know, he was the guy who was kind of showing us, you know, how to do it. And I just learned, you know, we'd watch movies together all the time and just love talking to him about movies, especially like movies from the 20s, silent movies. He was obsessed with silent expressionistic acting and all this stuff. And he was obsessed with Travis Bickle, Taxi Driver. And, you know, those characters weren't like necessarily likable characters. And with Joaquin Phoenix in The Master.
Right.
There's this Lynn Ramsey movie now with Joaquin Phoenix. I don't know if you guys have seen it yet. It's being released pretty soon.
You Were Never Really Here?
Yeah. I saw it in Cannes last year. I wasn't a big fan of the movie, but gosh, he's just such an unlikable character in so many of his movies, you know.
Yeah.
And I,
he's great though.
He's amazing, you know. But I was like, man, you know, we got a lot of backlash because we wrote Anton's character as this kind of dark guy. But I'm like, well, why don't they apply that same scrutiny to these Joaquin Phoenix performances? You know, we're kind of like, ah. Or Daniel Day-Lewis in
There Will Be Blood.
And There Will Be Blood, or even in
Phantom Thread.
In Phantom Thread, he's kind of, you know,
exactly, yeah,
disgusting sometimes.
Absolutely.
And everybody was like, "Oh, this is so intelligently written and all this stuff," and all, and I'm like, "Man, what? How come Paul Thomas Anderson gets a pass and you know, we don't get the same kind of, I don't know. It was interesting. I think if Anton were around, I think he would have a lot of really interesting things to say about his character and how he saw them and how he does, because I gave him a lot of freedom about how he wanted to design it. And at one point, Jim Jarmusch, who's our executive producer, he said he read a draft of the script and he said, "Oh man, can you make Anton a little less sad? Can you make Jake like? Can you make Jake's character like a little less like creepy and tragic?" And you know, because he knew. I think Jim has a good sense of that, of like how audiences may respond to those types of things. Mm-hmm. And I'm a little worried that sometimes in his own films he's pandering just a little bit. You know,
right.
Like he's making his characters more likable than they have to be because he's a little bit worried that people are going to be tune out of the story too quickly,
right,
if they don't find the characters sympathetic.
That's got to be a weird line to navigate, the anticipation of the audience reaction versus like the sacrificing of authenticity, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, but you don't want the audience to tune out of the story. If you do,
right.
And especially if you're making movies on Jim's level, and I think he has a responsibility to his backers and all these, you know, people to get the movie out there. It's somebody I can't speak for, but I think also he generally, his movies are very affectionate towards his characters, and he can't, I think he told me once that he has a problem with making his characters suffer. And that's like the opposite of like the Coen brothers.
Yeah,
all they do is like torture their characters.
What's that movie? The regular, A Serious Man?
Serious Man. Yeah. Oh,
that's all that is.
It's pure torture.
Yeah.
Like, how can we make this guy's life worse by the minute, you know? Yeah. So I don't know. Yeah, different aesthetics, different approaches. I think we were. I didn't have like any kind of like. I didn't want to see Anton's character suffer. I just wanted it to be like a coherent thing within the text of the film. Yeah, exactly.
No,
yeah.
I mean, it is. It very much feels
off-putting.
Right.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, this is a difficult love story in a lot of ways. Because
yeah.
I know, watching it myself, there were times when I was a little bit like, oh my god, you know, Jake, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah.
Like, it was.
You have to channel the worst of yourself to understand him.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was one of those things where I didn't necessarily identify with Jake, but I understood him, and mm-hmm. I understood where he was coming from. And as well with Lucy Lucas's character as well, I wanted to ask, how did you approach writing this kind of love story? A love story that is dark in a lot of ways, is especially in that third part of it, it's very sexual. It's something that audience might not be ready for. How did you approach, you know, making this kind of story?
Well, it's a combination of things. It's like trying not to follow the tropes of most romantic movies. Like, first of all, I think kind of, you know, I love romantic comedies. I love love stories and movies. I think it's one of my favorite genres. I just think it's, you know, there's something really, yeah, like you get a bird's eye view into somebody, this intimate thing that you would never get in real life, right? You're never going to be part of that. I can even, you know, like in romantic relationships I've been in, I can feel sometimes like the frustration of my friends and family, like my mom or my best friends being like, hey, we haven't seen you in a few weeks. What's going on in your life? You know, and you're just kind of, you don't want to talk about it. You want to keep it for yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's so great about most movies that center on an intimate romance like that is you really feel like they're privileged to be able to kind of, you know, voyeuristically kind of look into this affair that's unfolding. So so it was a combination of that, the affection for that genre, but not wanting to follow the same footsteps as everybody else.
Right. So with so many movies that just take a single-minded approach or just all attack romantic relationships in the same way, it's nice that a movie like Porto takes a more difficult approach to it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I want to, with that last third, because it really builds, you know, talking about form and talking about how the story progresses both emotionally and narratively. When we, the first two, I guess, acts, two sections, we don't see the actual affair itself. We see kind of the edges of it and the aftermath and what leads into it. But when we get to that third section and you're shooting these incredibly intimate scenes that, you know, if you don't mind me saying, look beautiful.
Right.
They look very beautiful. Was it difficult to have that kind of, you know, pretty in-your-face sexual content, you know, shooting that with Anton and Lucy? How did that go for you guys?
Yeah, so like I'd say, you know, adding to the romantic movies that I enjoy that, let's say, are made in like the American studio system, there are also a lot of like European art house and movies that are about intimate relationships that show that other side that a lot of the Hollywood movies don't show, like sex, mm-hmm. right? Like, you know, as a critic with my critic hat on, you know, I'd watch things like Knocked Up and be like, why does she have her bra on? You know, like,
who does that?
Yeah, PG-13.
Yeah, yeah, is
that's
it?
Why. No, it's not.
And like, I think it's because something in Catherine Hagel's contract. But you know, it's like you don't see that sort of. You're watching it, and you're like aware of the apparatus around. You know, like when you're watching, there's this Israeli movie from the early 2000s called Late Marriage, and there's a sex scene in the middle of the movie that goes on for like 30 minutes. And it's amazing. It's one of the best sex scenes I've ever seen in a movie. Everybody talks about Bertolucci. They talk about, gosh, what else? What's that Nicholas Roeg film? Is it Performance? No, not Performance. That's
not sure.
There's another with Donald Sutherland. There's this like really long with Julie Christie and Donald Sutherland.
With Donald Sutherland?
Yeah.
In a really long sex scene.
I was already traumatized by seeing his butt in Animal House. You know, like, but if you really want to see Donald Sutherland, you know, in a very kind of sexy.
I've been looking for that.
You have? Well, you found it. you know, there's, but. Yeah, there's this Israeli film, Late Marriage, was really big inspiration because the characters were just, like, usually the sex scene is the climax, it happens, it's wonderful, and then life goes on, and then you get, you know, the next scene or whatever. I mean, I went to see, my fiancé and I, we went to see the 50 Shades of Grey sequel movie, just, I don't know, because we're masochistic or something.
51 Shades of Grey.
51 Shades, 52. I didn't know until I saw that the character's name is Grey. And that's why it's called that, you know, like, I was like, oh God. But that's like how sex is set up. Like that movie's sort of marketed as a risque movie about sex, but it's actually the opposite. It's the most conservative treatment of sex that you'd ever see in a movie because it treats sex as a sort of payoff as if it was like an action movie kind of.
Yeah.
Like and then they just move on to the next absurd plot point. So I'm going to contrast that with this Israeli film because these two characters, they have sex and then we're like, okay, what's next? Like, I guess we saw the best part of the movie and there's still another hour of this and they're just lying around in bed and, you know, they're just talking about what they did. They're just kind of rolling around. They're just kind of, you know, largely in an unbroken take and
just kind of like pastoral approach to that kind of scene.
And then they like eventually in like 15 minutes, they have sex again and, you know, and then they talk about that again, you know, and it just feels so natural, and it just feels really wonderful and true, much truer to the experience of sex itself, or intimacy itself. I won't just say sex.
Because that's what it really comes off as. It is the way that they look at each other.
Yeah.
Is really incredible. It's hard not to be drawn into this idea that it's, while it is sexual in nature, it is so intimate.
And, it's not a beat.
No, right. It's not a beat. It's not just like, oh, wow, that was kind of hot. Like,
right.
Especially with the way the film is bookended with that loving look. I think that's what it captures, and it's I'd be really interested to see this Israeli film now, because it's a film about sex, you know, and doing that sort of thing, just the way this is about intimate relationships, and they just talk about it a little bit.
Yeah, or you see like Andy Warhol movies where just the camera's running and like in a more kind of aggressively temporal way, where it's just like duration of things. You know, this Blue Movie is where Viva and her partner, I forget the actor's name, but they're just, it's 90 minutes of just the two people eloping, and I don't know. I think that if you're in a romantic situation like that, where it is you're meeting for the first time, you sort of confuse intimacy, authentic intimacy, let's say, like emotional intimacy, with physical intimacy. So I think that's happening.
Sure.
And in the story, we were very conscious of that. We were also very conscious about the idea of these characters declaring themselves to each other. And when that because when you're in that situation, that's kind of what you do a little bit. You're kind of going crazy. You don't know how to put this into words. And a lot of what you're saying kind of sounds ridiculous or banal or whatever. But it happens to all of us. It even happens in that first film in the Before trilogy.
Sure.
A lot of the dialogue in that is like, it's hard to listen to because it makes you kind of cringe. You know?
How can these people be in love? Yeah. And, you know,
Or not be,
especially, you know, later on things fall apart for the two characters.
Plays into the haunting aspect of the end.
Absolutely. But maybe it's just because I was wrapped up in the visuals and just the performances here in Porto. But it made me think about what it was like to be in that moment of first infatuation.
Right.
What feelings are real, what are just kind of part of the moment. So Porto really captures that. It's fantastic. You can actually get it now if you're interested in purchasing the Blu-ray. You can get it, you know, pretty much anywhere Blu-rays are
through
sold.
Kino Lorber
or any other venue.
I think it's actually cheaper on Kino's website than on Amazon, so
probably.
Well done, Kino Lorber.
Yeah.
And then sold me.
Also, in a couple of weeks, it will be on Netflix.
Yeah, it'll be April 16th on Netflix. If you know, now I can answer that dreaded question: is it on Netflix?
Yeah.
Right?
Soon.
Yeah, soon.
And the answer is...
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, but that's kind of like a graveyard. We were going to talk... I don't know if we have time. Yeah.
Are we? Yeah, just chat a little bit about the process of getting it onto Netflix, because we talked a little bit about it off mic. There's a lot of checks and balances. Yeah,
what's the three flag situation they got going there?
So I first heard about this from Joe Swanberg, who, of course, has done a number of things for Netflix now. I don't know if this is any kind of secret process. I think there are articles about it online. But they're very rigorous about how they like flag things that might not appear good, in their
aesthetic.
Exactly. So there's definitely like a Netflix aesthetic. They kind of want things to kind of look the same. Mm-hmm. And they're definitely more into digital, like delivery from things that were captured digitally than captured on film. Like grain drives them crazy, right? Because they want people's TV sets to just be like clean and, you know, and so like Joe shoots a lot of stuff on Super 16, and he was saying that, yeah, like there will be little things that happen, lens flares, little things that happen when you're shooting on film. So much can happen, right? Because it's just organic material, light rushing through, you know, negative. And so they have this system where they say, okay, this thing, you definitely have to correct it. Change it, change the pixels, change whatever, you know, airbrush it here, whatever.
Right.
This thing we strongly encourage you to, and this thing is optional. So it's like a red flag, a yellow flag, and like a screen. I don't know.
But you shot Porto with three different types of film.
Yeah.
So that's three different classes of problems that Netflix has. Yeah.
They're going to be shitting themselves, honestly.
Well, we had actually, we didn't have many flags from Netflix, but we had Google flag our trailer because there's a shot, like a very brief, not even 1 second shot of Lucy's character flicking the camera off. And we had to put a black censorship bar over Lucy's finger.
Oh, just over the finger?
Yeah, so just over the finger.
It's the same thing.
The distributor said, or the delivery people, they said, cut it out. And I said, no, I'm going to highlight the censorship aspect of it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Actually, if you're really savvy, if you look really quickly at the trailer, only on Google, not on YouTube, not on any of the other streaming providers, but if you look on Google Play at our trailer, there's like a black bar over Lucy's middle finger.
Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah. Gabe Klinger sticking it to the man.
Yeah,
take
right.
that, Google. But even though it will be available on these streaming platforms, I do have to say, Kino Lorber sent us the Blu-ray copy. It is stunning. All the little imperfections and all the little parts of it, the quality of the film looks fantastic. So, and as I said earlier, it does come with the bonus documentary, Double Play, that you did with James Benning and Richard Linklater. Audio commentary from you as well.
Yeah.
Was that fun, doing the audio?
No.
Is it difficult terrible. To go back and watch
probably
that?
About as fun as this is.
No, this is way more fun than the audio commentary. Are you kidding me? Being in like a cabin alone with no direction, no prompting. I should have done like the Anchorman approach where like you invite like Lou Rawls into your recording session, or like Paul Thomas Anderson with Boogie Nights. I should have had like a bong in, you know. I should have been like taking bong hits while I was doing it.
So here's something. The deal with the
there it is. Hold on one sec, just to kind of get a little bit of water.
Yeah, there you go.
So Porto.
We'll add that. We'll add that in graphics
add
later.
That. Cool. Please. All right. Thank you again, Gabe. You know what? Actually, before we go, you teased it too many times. Top hockey films of all time.
All
go
right.
For it.
We got Mighty Ducks, Miracle, and Goon, and then that's all. You mentioned the
Slapshot.
Slapshot.
Yeah, you gotta have Slapshot.
That's probably the best of the bunch.
I mean, I'm also a big fan of sports movies. I have to say hockey's not we're still, I think, waiting for the great hockey movie.
Yeah, it has been strangely shortchanged.
Yeah.
Like you never see it. It's always
Well, that's
you know,
what I like about Goon. Goon takes a kind of a weird, like, it breaks down what a hockey movie is, and it makes it about like a particular role within a hockey team, which
yeah,
I like.
Well, it highlights the part about hockey that people, I would say, enjoy, like on a, you know, on a kind of darker level, enjoy the most. People sell hockey to others like, oh, there's fights,
right?
With like the part that people always kind of complain about is like, oh yeah, it's just a bunch of drunk dudes fighting, you know, they don't really know what they're doing,
but it's a role within the team, which is a cool deconstruction of the hockey film genre. Like,
right, I mean, but you don't get what exactly. And I love Goon for that, but you don't get in hockey films what you get in baseball films, which is this sort of commentary on the American dream,
right?
Because baseball history has been so entangled with that.
Right.
So I love, you know, I think baseball films have been exploited for that particular, you know, like kind of the way that they stir up certain ideas in this sort of American dream landscape, especially like a masterpiece, which I just recently rewatched, Field of Dreams.
Yeah.
Oh my God!
It's hard.
Amazing movie.
Yeah, it's hard Field not to American get. You dreams. Get so drawn up in it. And it's like if you build it, they will come. And it's amazing.
I have this German friend. He doesn't know anything about baseball, and he loves Field of Dreams. You know, it's just like he's obsessed with it.
Do you think that you could make the Great American Hockey Movie?
Oh geez, I'd have to learn a few things about hockey. I don't think I know enough. Baseball, I used to play. I made this movie about these two guys who used to play baseball, Linklater and Benning. Mm-hmm. I love baseball as a sport. I go to see games as often as I can. So I don't know. I think I'd try my hand at that before making a hockey film. But why not? I wouldn't refuse a hockey script if a good one came my way. Yeah.
Well, you've heard it. You've
We're
heard
waiting
it here
for it.
First.
Yeah.
You know, Gabe Klinger is looking for your hockey script.
Could probably get Canadian funding for it.
I believe it. Because they're, I would say Canada's pretty good about, they do a lot of funding for films, or at least I know they did back when David Cronenberg was making movies. You get stuff like The Brood. Ooh.
Especially hockey films.
Yeah.
Like, that's like a subgenre up there. Oh. Yeah.
That's well. That maybe that's our next dive in is to the world of Canadian hockey cinema.
Yeah,
there you go.
I mean, there is a lot to talk about there.
Naturally,
probably.
All right, Gabe Klinger, writer and director of Porto. It is available through Kino Lorber now on Blu-ray. It's going to be on Netflix later this month. Gabe, thank you so much. What an enlightening conversation.
Yeah, thanks, guys. It was fun. Yeah.
All right, you have been listening to No Coast Cinema here on WGN Plus. I'm Tom Hush.
And I'm Connor Cornelius.
And we will see you all next time. See you right now.